Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our Yoga Sutra Book Study Club, Sadhana Pada, Session 2. Last session, we started exploring the second book of the Yoga Sutra, Sadhana Pada. And we only covered two sutras, right? Two sutras. So it seems like we really spent a lot of time on just a very small portion of the book. But what that really highlighted was that that beginning is, really sets the stage for the entire sadhana pada. Looking at how the second book of the Yoga Sutra shifts our perspective and begins by acknowledging that a great deal of what we experience in our life is an expression of our desire to transcend all forms of pain, suffering, and limitation. And that seeking samadhi isn't necessarily our primary goal, but rather learning to live a happy, fulfilled life is our goal. And that sense of happiness and fulfillment is another word for saying that we want to overcome all forms of pain and limitation. And understanding how to do that and how to live in that way is exactly what sadhana pada is all about. And that's the context in which this beautiful idea of Kriya Yoga, the combined power of tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishwara Pranidhana, was introduced. Those three words are immense. That's why we spent a whole session talking about them. That there's some kind of extraordinary spiritual alchemy that takes place through this power of tapas, transcending our resistance to change and engaging in any practice that allows us to recover or to restore, awaken the innate wisdom of our body and unfold the immense power of our mind. These two unique phrases that Panditji speaks about in this book. It's a big idea. A lot of different things can be tapas. And when we do that, we unleash a power that allows us to begin to know ourselves at deeper levels. Working with that is called swadhyaya, understanding who we are from the inside out. And that process of discovering who we are seems very simple, but it's extraordinarily rich. And ultimately, once we not just intellectually know who we are, but experience who we are, and experience that self-awareness manifesting in our fulfillment, we find a sense of completion. And that naturally leads us to Ishwara Pranidhana, the state where we're so filled with gratitude that we're able to embrace the best in ourself and begin to realize that actually we're not embracing it, but rather it's embracing us from all directions and in every way. Our life fully embraces us. We can never find fulfillment in that grand sense if we're trying to accumulate that fulfillment through an never-ending series of experiences and achievements. We're always one experience short, or there's always one thing that can be taken away. But when we realize that life itself is a gift, and that we experience that gift through our tapas and swadhyaya, through our purposeful engagement in life, that is an experience that can never be taken away. And that's what Ishwara Pranidhana is all about. A living life in the light of these three principles is what Kriya Yoga is all about. And really, that's what allows us to transform practice into sadhana, which was the theme of last week. And we ended with a sutra that said that the goal of yoga is to experience samadhi and, which is the unique addition now in sadhana pada, and to attenuate the kleshas, our afflictions. So we recognize that the experience of yoga is really like a spectrum of experiences. It's a continuum. It's not like an on or off state that, well, we're practicing yoga and all of a sudden light bulb flashes and we achieve samadhi and it's done, and everything before that, God only knows what it was. Everything before that is as rich as whatever this somewhat mysterious state of samadhi is all about. And that's a unique idea that's being introduced now in Sadhanapada, that the goal of yoga is to help us attenuate, minimize, contain, transform all of our afflictions, all of those things which bring us pain. It's the very natural question then, after Sutra 2.2, is tell us more about the nature of affliction, of kleshas. What is the root cause of our suffering? Because yoga is all about going to the root. It's not a superficial, quick and easy kind of approach. It does take some significant degree of self-effort and trust that we have the capacity to grow. So yoga doesn't shy away at looking at the root causes, looking at the problems. What I find very intriguing is that we begin with the solution. That's what Sutras 2.1 and 2.2 are about. The solution is Kriya Yoga, Tapas Swadhyaya Ishwar Pranidhana. And a solution to a problem that's only introduced later. Kleshas are the root cause of our issue. And that's exactly where we dive in. We begin at Sutra 2.3. 2.3 is a list of what these kleshas are. Ignorance, false sense of self-identity, attachment, aversion, and the fear of death are the afflictions. So these five are five very famous words: avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, and abhinivesha. Sometimes when you see a list, it feels like, oh, it's just another list of things to take care of. So the important thing here that we'll spend the rest of the session talking about is, what do these five words really mean? Because they're extremely profound. We're not trying to list all of our weaknesses just so that we can feel bad about ourselves. We're trying to understand how these five kleshas can be transformed into pure power. That's the amazing thing. The goal of this is to attenuate the influence of these afflictions in our life and transform them into our source of strength. It's a very life-affirming way of looking at afflictions, that when put in the right context, the same things which are our bondage can be transformed into the source of our freedom. And that begins at the very beginning, the root of all of the afflictions, known as avidya. In that regard, we'll jump over to 2.4 and 2.5. We'll look at them together. 2.4 tells us that ignorance, avidya, is the ground for the remaining afflictions. So it's a very clear statement that all of our afflictions really emerge from this word avidya. They're an expression of it. If avidya is like that seed, and then once that seed germinates and grows, it grows into these remaining four. This word avidya is a word that's been used in a number of different ways, many of which at times I think are more confusing, complex than they need to be. And in many regards, it almost is something that has been used to in a way that makes us feel bad about ourselves. That ignorance is that state which is so subtle and all-pervading that it's absolutely indescribable, impossible to understand. So don't really even bother with trying to figure out how it started. Just know that this is a problem that all of us have and we need to deal with it. That's not very useful. In fact, it feels like it's just a cop-out, that, well, we can't do any better, so let's give up. And that's completely opposite to what Patanjali and the Yoga Sutra is talking about. In fact, this word avidya is used in sometimes in a different context than other schools of Vedic philosophy that aren't quite as life-affirming. Yoga is very clear that we're not here to feel bad about ourselves, but to understand what gives power to avidya, ignorance in the first place, and tap into that to turn what appears to be a weakness at face value into a strength. Sutra 2.5 goes into a definition of what avidya is all about. Before you read that, the place to begin looking at avidya is to see that avidya, or ignorance, is fundamentally a state of awareness where we're not completely clear on who we are. It's a lack of familiarity with ourselves. And it's a hard thing to really begin to form a relationship with this. What does it mean that I'm not familiar with who I am? I am whatever I am. This is my name. Here's where I was born. Here's what I've achieved. Here's where I come from. But as we start going through that process, we realize that this is a long list of attributes that I've been told about myself. What I know about myself today is quite external. It's not something that I've really understood about myself from the inside. And what this points at is that so much of our identity is an identity that's defined by our senses and sensory engagement, by our external world. That's the entry point to really thinking about avidya. How much do I really know about myself that I've learned about independent of anything that I've been told from the outside? And how relative are all those identities? We start to see that it's extremely, what we know about ourselves is very subjective, very relative. And it's sometimes almost like a house of cards. It all starts from a very murky, shaky foundation. Why do I believe this about myself? Where did that start? Avidya is all about trying to cultivate a relationship with ourself that's not dependent on any external identity. Rather than thinking about who we are and trying to intellectually rationalize all of these different labels that we've assumed, try to feel who we are from the inside. Try to become aware of awareness itself rather than an intellectual dimension of awareness. So avidya, in its most essential form, is a lack of familiarity with who we are at our deeper levels. And it's a very subtle thing. That's why all these other descriptions that it's indescribable, so on and so forth, come in. It goes to the very heart of who we are and our identity. Another way of looking at avidya is that avidya is a conditioning of the mind. It's like a lens over how we see ourselves, how we see the world, how we see our life. Another word for conditioning is identity, which is a word that I've used quite a bit in the last 5 minutes. The reason why avidya is so subtle is that it's like that lens is just built into our quote-unquote eye. If you never have seen yourself without that, you don't even know that there's something which is in between that seeing power in you and how you see yourself. You think that this is the only way that it can be. And that's where we can actually start getting to the deeper power behind avidya, which is very important because it helps us to understand what makes avidya real, ignorance real in the first place, and how can we tap into that so that we can discover this deeper reality that we're talking about, this awareness of ourself, which is grounded in a true and profound familiarity with ourself rather than something external. And this is where we have to have some kind of foundation to rest on. You might call it like a fundamental axiom or assumption. And the word assumption is not the word I really want to use because it sounds like it's a guess. We have to have some firm ground to stand on when we take our first step. And in the school of yoga, that firm ground for the first step is that there is an immense and pristine power of awareness that resides at my core being. I am pure awareness at my core, the heart of my being. And I have the potential to be aware of that. That first step helps us to unravel the mystery of where this ignorance began. Because it's very simple, in fact, that seeing power within us is like that infinitely luminous sun at the heart of our solar system. And it expresses itself through this immense power of the mind. The mind is like a tool that allows this power of awareness to be focused and directed outward. And that mind expresses itself through all of the powers of our senses, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and hearing. And the seeing power is so powerful, so rich, so real, that when it flows through our senses and we see ourselves in the world in this myriad of different ways that our senses allows us to, it projects a sense of reality which is so powerful, so captivating, that we forget that it's the seeing power that's perceiving and believe it to be us. And we begin to claim all of those different experiences as our own, rather than realizing that we're experiencing something that's external to us. The seeing power and that which the seeing power sees kind of become one. And we are fully identified with all of our experiences in the world. All those experiences become our various identities. All those different aspects of ourself that we call to be who we are. We create our own reality. And that reality, it's not that that reality is bad. It's incomplete. And it fails to acknowledge that that reality is real to us because of the reality, the power of that seeing power within us, that seer within us. It's a misunderstanding. It's called the cosmic misunderstanding, that the reality of the world doesn't come from the outside. It comes from the inside. And we've forgotten that. As soon as that happens, a infinitely subtle process of identifying with all these experiences and identities starts. It's so subtle that it's hard to trace and pinpoint the beginning. All we know is that I know myself to be this today. This is how I understand myself to be. And it's this is where yoga has a difference of opinion with other schools. Yoga says there's no shame in acknowledging that right now I understand myself to be Ishan in Honesdale, Pennsylvania, and having such and such interests and qualities, characteristics, relationships. That is my reality. What yoga says is acknowledge that and see that you are more, and understand where that reality comes from. Don't deny the fact that we are such and such and such, but remind ourselves that we're more than our whatever we've defined ourselves to be today. That whatever we've defined ourselves to be today is an expression of avidya, because it's not all that we are. That's the point here. Avidya is our lack of familiarity with who we are in our totality, with who we are in essence. Once we start to expand and understand ourselves in a broader way and understand the essence of ourself, we transform avidya, or ignorance, into vidya, or knowledge. That's where we begin to transform our limitations and our bondage into a source of freedom. It's a shift in perspective. But we're jumping a few steps ahead. I like to talk about the positive way, how we can work with avidya, because trust me, there's 100 times more commentaries written on the negative part of avidya than the positive part, because that's a human quality itself, to focus on the negative. Avidya is our lack of familiarity with ourself, which in Sutra 2.4 is defined, 2.5, is defined in a very intriguing way. Mistaking short-lived objects for eternity, mistaking impurity for purity, mistaking suffering for happiness, and mistaking non-being for pure being is avidya, ignorance. All that is really summarized by saying, mistaking the unreal for the real. Mistaking the incomplete for the complete. That's avidya. It's exactly where this ancient prayer that so many different traditions recite, asato ma sadgamaya. That's where this idea comes from. Please lead me from the unreal to the real. Lead me from an experience of avidya, ignorance, to an experience of vidya, lasting and genuine self-knowledge. Avidya is the root of all of the other afflictions, because it's that state where we're not sure of who we are. And because we're not sure, we're quite adamant that I must be this, 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 and this. Because we need to have something to hold on to. We need to have an identity. How does that state of avidya manifest in the other kleshas? Avidya forces us to define our identity in a very specific way. Because we're not sure who we are, we need to find some kind of external reference point. That's like a boundary. That's like a, we have to draw a circle around my space, around who I am. That tendency, and tendency is a mild word, very deeply rooted tendency, klesha, is called asmita, the power of identification, our ego. And that's what Sutra 2.6 is talking about. And it's important to say that it's a distorted sense of self-identity, because we're not trying to say here that self-identity intrinsically is a bad thing. When we don't understand the power of this identity, the fullness of this identity, and the source of this identity, it becomes distorted, limited. And it's a very simple assertion that we should never limit our potential. We should remind ourselves that human life is an opportunity to experience our infinite grandeur. That was one of the foundational messages of the secret of the Yoga Sutra, Samadhipada, that every human being is an island of excellence, that life is a gift to experience that fullness. Anything which limits our capacity to see our expansiveness is bondage. And that's what asmita is all about, a distorted sense of self-identity where we're rigidly defining who we are because we're not sure of who we are. We're coming from a place of avidya. Sutra 2.6 defines asmita in an interesting way. Asmita arises from the apparent oneness of the power of the perceiver and the power of perception. That's exactly what we just spoke about, that root which I was describing also as the root of avidya in the first place. That when we think that our power of perception and what we're perceiving are one and the same, or rather the power of the perceiver and the power of perception, who we are on the inside and its ability to perceive. Once we see that they're one and the same, we don't realize that one is simply a tool and the other one is the source of that power. The power of the perceiver inside of us is different than the perceiver. Just like we know that our sense organs, our eyes and ears, nose, mouth, tongue, our skin, that is distinct from whatever gives it its function in our brain in the first place. That's a nice analogy. That's obvious because we've studied it. That there is some capacity in our brain which allows our eyes to work. And if even if our eyes are fully healthy, if that part of our brain is not healthy, the eyes won't work. Therefore, we know that the power that makes the eyes work is distinct from the eyes. Imagine that at a more subtle level, that the power of perception itself is like this tool of perception. Where does it come from? It's deeper than that power of perception. It's coming from a very deep place. It's extremely subtle. And that's where only experience can help us understand it. Trying to distinguish between the tool for perception and the power that rests behind it. That's why the entire path of yoga is really based on the idea of becoming aware of more and more subtle dimensions of our being, more and more subtle dimensions of awareness. And going back to this analogy of our physiology is a great one. There might have been a time when we really believed that our eyeballs are the source of our power of sight, that actual organ is where all that power resides. All sorts of more ancient cultures, they valued organs for that reason, that there's some power in the organ. Now, with more study, we're realizing that it's certain functions within our brain and a much more nuanced sense of our neurophysiology that creates potential for sight, smell, hearing, tasting, and touch. We're trying to go one step beyond that, actually two or three steps beyond that, that if there wasn't a deeper potential within, our brain would just be a pile of mush. That it's not the brain which has some kind of amazing magic of biochemistry, but rather consciousness. And that's where science has reached. What yoga is trying to do is further help us understand the source of consciousness itself. That's a big leap because it's non-physical. And even science acknowledges that there's some kind of, they wouldn't use the word miraculous most likely, but extraordinarily subtle and difficult to quantify, some kind of phenomenon which is happening. Yoga is clear that the reason why it's difficult to really categorize is that it's subtle and it requires us to unlock a certain capacity of the mind, not the brain. Once we do that in a systematic way, through the power of pranic awareness that we apply through the eight limbs, we begin to experience awareness in more and more subtle ways. That gives us a new meaning to what this literal translation of Sutra 2.6 is all about. That what are you talking about when you say the power of the perceiver and the power of perception? It's trying to help us see that the perceiver is distinct from its power of perception. Just like the eyeball is distinct from the power that comes from that part, from a certain part of the brain. And that the deeper power of the brain comes from consciousness. There's a couple steps beyond that. The only way to really know it is to experience it. Another way of looking at asmita is somehow to reflect on how is it possible that consciousness, which we know is extremely vast, maybe infinitely vast, becomes bound and defined in such a narrow specific way where I can only feel my consciousness from the top of my head to my toes, that only a couple square feet of, or a couple cubic feet is mine. How does consciousness become so limited? It's a paradoxical thing when you think about it, especially as you become more attuned to the idea that consciousness is really vast, really powerful. Our consciousness is far more powerful, certainly more powerful than our body, more powerful than our brain, It's like it's a billion watts trying to flow through a little 100-watt light bulb. Consciousness is way, way more powerful than this light bulb can handle. And for the sake of the light bulb, only a little bit flows through it. It's much more. So how is it that that became contained in such a small vessel? That's the power of Asmita. And again, it's inspiring. It's not, it shouldn't be frightening or discouraging that this happened. Consciousness is so powerful that it can create this wall for our convenience so we can experience ourselves in a very specific way. In proportion to our desire and capacity to find freedom in our expansion, that power of Asmita grows more subtle and more expansive and less limiting. Asmita, this distorted self, sense of self-identity, makes us grow smaller and smaller. The opposite happens when we transform Asmita. We grow bigger and bigger. But we have to go a bit deeper down the rabbit hole. I keep going back to the positive. So what happens when we have a distorted sense of self-identity, Asmita, that's emerging out of the fertile ground of avidya, a lack of familiarity with who we are, and a firm conviction that whatever I've experienced my world to be is it. That distorted self, sense of self-identity germinates in a very specific way that Yoga Sutra terms as raga, in Sutra 2.7. Raga is always translated as attachment, but the literal translation here of Sutra 2.7 is quite intriguing. It says that affliction that has pleasure as its resting ground is attachment. This distorted sense of self-identity propels us to define our world in a more and more specific way. We need more and more tangible reference points to our identity. This is who I am because this is what I like. This is who I am because this is what I enjoy. I am what I experience. So here, we use the word that affliction that has pleasure as its resting ground. Any place that we allow our identity to coalesce, any place where we choose to quote-unquote rest for a little while and allow our awareness to rest, we form a relationship with that quote-unquote place, experience. And in and of itself, that's not a big deal. It's wonderful to appreciate and enjoy wherever we are. The problem lies in our Asmita's intense desire to say, and this is another reference point for defining who I am. We grow attached to that particular pleasant experience. We're not even able to enjoy it because we're so worried about owning it. And that's the amazing thing about pleasure. It's only partially pleasurable because a big portion of our mind is almost obsessed with the amount of effort to reach there and the fear of leaving it. We're just not able to be present, to use this that kind of somewhat overused cultural phrase, just be present. It's much harder than the bumper sticker tells us. To truly be present, we need to understand the power of raga, this affliction, where there's a very powerful tendency to become attached to those experiences which we define to be pleasant, and they're pleasant because they reinforce who we are or they give further definition to who we are. Rather than simply appreciating them, acknowledging them, and enjoying them, we file them away as another one of our mental possessions. That's what raga is all about. And the amazing thing about this raga is that it's the power of desire that is all-consuming. It's so subtle that we don't know when we slipped from simply enjoying a pleasant experience to wanting to really hold on to it tightly. And it completely engulfs us in all directions. That's the nature of desire, that it's like a force that surrounds us from all sides. It takes over. We're no longer in the driver's seat. It's largely on autopilot. That's why desire in this, and desire and attachment are really two sides of the same coin, has been vilified to the point where in many Eastern spiritual traditions, it's turned into an actual anthropomorphic demon. It's like the descriptions of Buddha in battle with Mara, desire, for 40 days, for instance, 40 nights. It's very powerful and it's extremely subtle because raga is fueled by our deepest identities, that distorted sense of self-identity called asmita. It completely shapes how we see ourselves and how we see the world. The direct counterpart to raga, and I wouldn't even call it the next link in the chain, but rather, you know, out of asmita, distorted sense of self-identity, springs two shoots, if you will. The first is attachment. The second is dvesha, usually translated as aversion. And it seems like, well, how is aversion, something I don't like, how is that powerful? I'm not bound by something I don't like because I don't like it. I'm not going to give it any energy. I'm not going to give it any time. And the truth of the matter is that in many regards, the things that we dislike are almost have a greater power over us than the things that we like. And modern science and psychology is kind of exploring this idea and this idea of the negativity bias, that those experiences which we perceive to be painful, which we perceive to be negative, have a much greater capacity to influence our behavior often than the ones which are pleasurable, because we're programmed to avoid pain, or what we define as painful. That's the amazing thing. One person's definition of pain is another person's definition of pleasure. It's extremely subjective and has a lot to do with our clarity of awareness or our cultural conditioning. But whatever we define to be that which we do not like is a very powerful element in our identity. It sculpts our worldview. It's as real as the power of attachment. And the literal translation of Sutra 2.8 talks about this, that affliction that has pain as its resting ground is aversion, dvesha. So just like we said that affliction which has pleasure as its resting ground is attachment, this is the exact opposite. Any place where our identity coalesces around an experience of pain forms a groove in our mind, a conditioning, an identity, which is known as dvesha, aversion. And we work very, very hard to avoid it. In fact, often we spend more energy trying to keep pain away or trying to fight off negativity than we do in trying to embrace the positive aspects or the pleasurable aspects of life. It's a real mystery. And it can feel a bit discouraging at times. The important thing to reflect on here is that both of these, attachment and aversion, are fed by this distorted sense of self-identity. They're not intrinsic to who we are, is a very important thing to remind ourselves. Pain is not my identity. Anger or aversion, negativity is not who I am. It's a reaction. It's a conditioning. It's something which I'm holding on to because I haven't discovered something better to hold on to. I haven't been able to transform this relationship to whatever that particular thing is in a way which is meaningful to me. We can't think our way out of negativity. We have to feel something deeper, more rich, so that we're genuinely able to let go of that, or at least loosen our grip and try to reach for something better. We need to look for something more inspiring rather than condemn ourselves about that which is not so inspiring. That's what the idea of working with our desire so that we can upgrade our desires, refine them rather than judge them, and see which aspects of ourself help us to cultivate a more and more clear self-understanding, something which transforms our asmita, our distorted sense of self-identity, into something which is more empowering and able to allow us to genuinely feel a deeper awareness of who we are. Because all of this comes from this lack of familiarity with ourself. We're groping in the dark. Largely because we're defining ourself only in context to our senses in the external world. And that changes every single moment. That's a big part of why the aging process is so frightening and so unfulfilling. It's not stable. We're looking for an anchor point of stability. That comes by experiencing a deeper part of ourself, which flows from the ultimate source of stability, that pure awareness within, which is what the goal of yoga is all about. These four kleshas all lead to the fifth klesha, which in many regards is like a, it's like the tree. You know, if we use this analogy that the avidya, our ignorance, is the seed, and it germinates and grows through asmita, which is a distorted sense of self-identity, raga, attachment, dvesha, aversion, that it really becomes full-blown. It's manifest. The fruit of that manifestation is abhinivesha, the fifth klesha, which is described in Sutra 2.9. And the literal translation of Sutra 2.9 is a good starting point, but it's a little bit cryptic. Fear of death carries its own essence and rides the consciousness of even the wise. Abhinivesha is full-blown, what's when our identity becomes completely crystallized, where we define ourselves by all of our likes and dislikes. Our identity is our likes and dislikes. And that's all we know ourselves to be. Anything which threatens that identity, anything which can lead to the loss of our identity, is that which is the source of greatest fear. And of course, ultimately, death is that which tears us away from everything we know ourselves to be. That's why this sutra, which again appears to be a little bit negative and heavy, fear of death, it goes right to the heart of it, that it's the fear of losing our identity which is what makes death painful. It's that death is not the fifth klesha, the fifth affliction. The fear of death is the klesha. Because we've defined our world, our personal world, our identity, in a very concrete way through all of our likes and dislikes. And we know that we won't be in a position to experience those likes and dislikes when this phenomena called death separates us from our world. We don't know where we're going, but one thing we know for sure is that we won't be aware of ourselves in the same way once we go, quote unquote, there. That all the things which I enjoy today may not be there. Oddly enough, all the things which I don't enjoy may not be there. And that's also a little bit painful because we define ourselves in that way. Fear of death is the fifth klesha. And it's so subtle and so all-pervading that it's been given the term abhinivesha. Because the word abhinivesha doesn't literally mean fear of death. It means that condition or that conditioning which penetrates every nook and cranny of our awareness. Every part of our being has been penetrated by this fear of death. There's no part of our external identity which is free from the fear of losing our identity. And that's the very nature of identity, that it's something that we define ourselves to be. Its fundamental nature is to try to protect itself. The fundamental nature of any identity is to preserve itself in the same way. I am this. If I'm not that, I am not. I am nothing. I need to protect. I need to protect. I need to protect. Fear of death is like a straitjacket that's made of iron. It just holds us tight. We can't move at all. It's a crippling condition where as soon as we say that this is what I'm comfortable defining myself as, there's a never-ending fear of losing it. It's like a straitjacket that we put on ourselves. And this is where, again, it feels really discouraging, like, wow, you're saying that there's no way out, that as soon as we say that this is who I am, I'm doomed? No. If we say that this is all I am, and that I'm only prepared to see myself this way, then we've set ourselves up for disappointment in the end, because we know that change is the very nature of creation. If we can find joy in that change, and in the transformation of one identity into the next, the same thing, which is a straitjacket, which is the most definitive expression of bondage, fear of death, is transformed into power. It's a very subtle shift, but a very important one. That the reason why fear of death is the ultimate klesha is that we are unwilling or incapable of shifting our relationship to all these identities. That's what Abhinivesha is all about. An amazing observation is made in the commentary here that I'll just touch on, that you can go back and read. It talks about how fear leads to a profound decline in our pranic potential, our healing potential. It has a lot to do with our navel center. And that as soon as there's a decline in this healing potential, a unique condition called old age creeps in. Old age isn't the result of time directly. Time is it's just the vehicle that old age rides. But old age really is brought to us through the power of fear and losing our identity, which is why it's said that no matter what our external age is, as measured by years, old age can find us if we live our life in fear. That state of fear leads to a profound decline of our healing potential, which is what we call the aging process. And ultimately, it's that process which leads to our disintegration and the phenomena that we've called death, which is a very mysterious phenomenon because we actually don't know exactly what death is. All we know is that it's the culmination point of our disintegration. This kind of state, where we're trying to manage this unending battle between the forces of decay and our innate potential to keep healing and growing. It's like a constant tug of war. That's what life is often defined by. The path of yoga is to begin unwinding this. It's not about trying to reverse the reverse the clock and go back in time and overcome the aging process itself, but it's trying to understand the very nature of fear of death and how our attachment and aversion fuels that. How those two are simply an expression of our distorted sense of self-identity. And ultimately, how that is an expression of our lack of understanding of who we are. If we can work up the chain, and we can undertake practices which allow us to do that, we can begin to master all of these kleshas. Master these afflictions, so we turn them from bondage into a source of freedom. And that's exactly what yoga is all about. this is a good place to go back to Sutra 2.4, the very the sutra that first introduces the idea of avidya, ignorance, where we say that ignorance is the ground for all the other kleshas. In the same sutra, the second half of the sutra that I didn't translate says that these kleshas can either be dormant, attenuated, disjointed, or active. So it really tells us that, again, the experience of the kleshas isn't an on and off state, that either we're completely defined by the kleshas or they're totally off and we're, you know, enlightened. It's not a one-step process. It's a lifelong experience of our transformation. It's a continuum of experience. And we have to work with these five kleshas in a progressive manner so that we can begin to find an entry point to break the momentum of these kleshas, because they've built up tremendous amount of momentum. It's very clear that right now, for the most part, we define our identity in context to our body and all of our sensory engagement with the world. That's how we see ourselves and experience ourselves. Anything which threatens that threatens our identity. All of the different things we do in the world are really driven by things that we like and going after them, or trying to avoid the things that we don't like. And that becomes the basis of our personality. What do we do with that? We try to find a deeper sense of awareness, to shine some light on all of our likes and dislikes, so that we can break this cycle of the kleshas. That's exactly what Kriya Yoga is all about. That when we practice and unfold the power of practice, which is called tapas, we begin to become a little bit more aware. We feel more empowered. And that allows us to break the cycle in what the Yoga Sutras is calling an experience of the kleshas that's disjointed. We begin to see small windows into a different way of seeing ourselves and feeling life, different experience of life that's not as defined by these afflictions. We feel more free. That there's going to be certain windows where I feel a little bit more liberated, more clear inside, more empowered, and less defined by my limitations. That's what Kriya Yoga, and specifically tapas and swadhyaya, this reflection on the deeper power of awareness, gives us. It's almost like snapping out of a dream and saying, oh wait, that was the dream, this is reality. It's a new way of seeing ourselves. It's a new way to decondition our mind. When we do that, the power of the kleshas is disjointed. That's the first stage. I should say the first stage is when they're fully active. We should assume that that's where we're beginning, and that we need to find anything which allows us to experience ourselves in a new way outside of our pre-existing likes and dislikes. And that's why tapas is part of it. Let me get out of my comfort zone. And let me do that in light of whatever my conscience is really inspiring me as what's in my what's for my greater good, what's truly right for me. And that's where typically things that are bringing some conscious awareness to our lifestyle, where we know that it's going to be a little painful because it's not what I'm used to, but I'll feel better. Just picking one thing and seeing how it makes us feel, that sense of clarity, empowerment, and freedom, even if it's just a micro experience of it, is extraordinary. It changes our perception. Acting from that kind of space is what allows us to move from an experience of the kleshas being full-blown or active into one where they're disjointed, where we have these windows to a deeper understanding of ourself. We reinforce that. We reinforce it through continual tapas and swadhyaya and Ishwar Pranidhana. we try to find the best in ourselves and build more and more of our lifestyle around that. And that leads to an experience of the kleshas that's attenuated, which is the exact word that was used in Sutra 2.2, that one of the goals of yoga is to attenuate the kleshas, to just try to contain their capacity to condition us. Make those windows of our awareness, that windows of clarity, bigger and bigger, so more and more of our life is defined by that rather than by our limitations. And from there, it's the simple but challenging formula of practice makes perfect. That continual, sustained practice that's really fully driven by compassion and a genuine desire for sustainable growth, whatever is truly right for us. There's this phrase of asking for what's truly good for us and not merely pleasant. Trying to understand what's truly good for us and working in that direction allows us to really bring the kleshas to a point where they're not just attenuated, but eventually dormant. And this is a perfect place to end, in that we're not trying to destroy our kleshas. We're trying to transform them so that their binding power is dormant. And that only comes through the power of true knowledge, experience. We're not intellectually saying that I am free now. We're feeling that, knowing it from the inside out. And as soon as that happens, the kleshas' binding power comes to an end. Those tendencies may remain within, but their ability to influence us is over. And that's where Sutra 2.10 leads us, which says, the afflictions are discarded at death only if they have become subtle. When they're dormant, when they no longer have a binding power over us, they don't carry forward. We reach a state of freedom here and now. And that's something that we really explored in great depth in the first book club of Samadhipada, in the idea of videhas and prakritilayas, two categories of yogis who reach a state of immortality because their identity becomes one with an experience of freedom from pain or inner luminosity. Their identity that was based on the afflictions is replaced by an identity of freedom from pain and inner clarity, luminosity. That becomes how they see themselves, and not just intellectually, but really experientially. When we find that in life, that's what carries forward. It's a very inspiring idea. That's what Sutra 2.10 tells us. And the question then, very logical question, is how can I have that? How can I transform my kleshas? Is there something more than Kriya Yoga, which is what we talked about in 2.1 and 2.2? And that's where we'll end tonight, in Sutra 2.11, which says, the mental tendencies, or vrittis, associated with the afflictions can be destroyed by meditation. This is a very simple but profound sutra that will lead us into the rest of our study of Sadhanapada, which says that these kleshas, these conditionings, these afflictions are what propel all of our vrittis, our mental tendencies, the roaming tendencies of the mind. We spent a lot of time talking about vrittis in the first book of the Yoga Sutra, that the goal of yoga is to help us gain mastery over these roaming tendencies. To gain mastery over them, we need to know what propels them. And that's what we're doing here. We're saying that the kleshas are what make the mind just roam incessantly through the universe, running, 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 running towards our desires or away from all of our objects of aversion. We can never stop moving. we need to retrain the mind to learn to be content and still. By transforming the kleshas, transforming that distorted sense of self-identity. And ultimately, that comes by knowing who we are. The process of knowing who we are, the process of transforming avidya, ignorance, into vidya, pure knowledge, is what's called meditation. And the word that's used in the sutra is dhyana, a word that's not yet been introduced, but should be familiar as one of the eight limbs, of course. So it's a little precursor into what comes later, little hint into about what comes later in this sadhanapada, that through the power of meditation, which is not meant to say that it's one limb in isolation to the others, but through a systematic means of experiencing who we are at deeper levels, we are able to transform the roaming tendencies of the mind, the vrittis, by transforming whatever it is that drives the vrittis in the first place, which is the kleshas. And that's a very powerful reason to learn more about what yoga is saying, and more about meditation. In our next session, we'll pick up from there. We're not going to pick up with the study of the eight limbs, but rather, we're going to go into an exploration of where did these, why is it that the mind is so defined by these roaming tendencies in the kleshas. We talked about that upon death, if these kleshas are dormant, if these afflictions are dormant, we're free from them. What happens if they're not? What is the result of our practice? And the answer to that question tells us a lot about how we came to be the way we are right now, which is very important because knowing that there is a deeper meaning behind how we reach where we are today is helps us to not feel helpless. We're empowered. And this path of yoga is a way to systematically unfold all of our potential. So next session, we'll cover sutras 212 to 217, looking at the law of karma and the nature of samskaras, subtle tendencies of the mind, and how they relate to the kleshas, and how they relate to the path of yoga. Thank you and good night.